and welcome to this week's CBI at 10. I'm Jeevan Vasagar. I'm climate editor at Tortoise. I'm also a former Singapore correspondent for the Financial Times. When I came back from Asia a few years ago, I felt that I was returning from the first world to an emerging market, complete with exciting politics. This session is intended to give us a sense of what's happening across the UK's devolved nations and regions. But of course, we're going to begin, I think, by thinking about the high drama in Westminster this week. We're going to start with John Foster, Director of the Policy Delivery Unit at the CBI. John, can you just start by catching us up on what's happened in the last 24 hours, indeed in the last few hours?
Yeah, Jeevan, lovely to be with you. Nice to see you all colleagues as well. Look, incredibly hectic last 24 hours. Let's just sort of take stock about how we've got to this point. In terms of choreography, we obviously had the resignation first of the Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, immediately followed by the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak. Now, look, the catalyst for this has been the Chris Pincher scandal, which has been well reported, and it led to the Health Secretary saying that he'd lost confidence in the Prime Minister, whilst the Chancellor said that the public expected government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously. But look, from a business perspective, the key takeaway here is probably actually the Chancellor's resignation letter, when he made it clear that there were pretty fundamental differences with the Prime Minister over the future of economic policy, how to deal with the cost of living crisis. Now, number 10 would have been on ministerial resignation watch last night. We've seen a few more junior ministers go this morning, but no more of the kind of classic big beasts. Instead, we've sort of seen statements of support from the Foreign Secretary, the Home Secretary, Dominic Raab, the Deputy Prime Minister, as well as some really politically significant cabinet figures like Michael Gove, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Culture Secretary, Nadine Dorries. Now, number 10 moved pretty quickly to fill the vacancies. They promoted Steve Barclay to Health Secretary, Nadeem Zahawi to Chancellor, as you all know, and Michelle Donnellan to Education Secretary. And we've worked incredibly closely with all three, just to reassure colleagues. We actually saw Michelle Donnellan just last week. We've had a really positive, constructive relationship with Steve Barclay in his old role as number 10 Chief of Staff. We've been feeding ideas into him and his team about how to get growth into the economy. And Nadeem Zahawi, the new Chancellor, someone who is very well known to us for his previous role as Vaccine Minister, but also obviously in the Education Department leading the skills brief. So look, just a quick word on how does this play out? Look, no one really knows, right? But Jacob Rees-Mogg took to the airways last night to say this is business as usual. Nothing to say, nothing to see here. At the same time, we have backbenchers like Andrew Bridgen saying the game is up for the Prime Minister. I think the important point here is it's all in flux. And actually, a lot of it is dependent on the internal workings of the Conservative Party. Now, having survived a vote of no confidence just last month, the Prime Minister technically has immunity from another vote of confidence for another year, for 12 months. But, and it's a pretty big but, the 1922 Committee, this is the group of Conservative MPs who essentially determine the rules, they're due to elect new members who could, in theory, change those rules to enable a fresh challenge to the Prime Minister at pretty quick speed. Now, that committee is believed to be meeting at some point today, with new members potentially elected and in place by Wednesday next week. So just the final thing to say here by way of opening is we have parliamentary recess on the 21st of July. It's just a couple of weeks away. So the 1922 committee will have to move pretty quickly, or the Prime Minister could get a reprieve until September. But I think just to sort of conclude, things remain, as the saying goes, pretty fluid right now.
So once again, we're watching gripped the sort of internal mechanics of the Conservative Party. And there's a quote that always comes to mind when I sort of think about this. And that was in the Sunday Times a few weeks ago, where someone said it's the role of the chief whip to bring Boris Johnson the brandy and the revolver. But if when that happens, Boris drinks the brandy and he shoots the chief whip with the revolver. So in terms of where the politics is and how this is going to play out, how much pressure do you think needs to come on to the Prime Minister for him to really reconsider his position? What's the dynamic at play here?
I mean, look, we're just about to enter what I think we at the CBI and Tony sort of build as peak politics. And look, the Prime Minister's always said he'd have to be dragged sort of kicking and screaming. And you can envisage that kind of scenario playing out. I think what colleagues listening on the call will be really focused on about is actually what does this mean for the economy? What does this mean for business? Actually, what we've kind of seen is we just started to regain a bit of momentum following the vote of no confidence. That understandably changed the focus in number 10 to really short-term political preservation. And there were just some encouraging signs that the economy just started to be prioritized again. We had a bit more activity focused on the economy. We had the long-awaited digital strategy, much to welcome in there. We had then a flurry of activity, the food security strategy, future freight strategy. Yes, there were gaps, there were questions on detail, but it was government starting to come forward with activity based on economic growth. What it lacked was a connecting thread, how it all comes together as a plan. And that was supposed to come via this big set piece economic speech with both the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, which we were expecting next week, where clearly there were really significant differences on opinion. Now, the details being worked out, but the expectation was that this was going to focus on outlining the government's plans for the economy. How do we grow the economy through these challenging economic headwinds? And we even heard rumours that the Prime Minister and Chancellor would start to deliver sort of COVID-style press conferences again on economic handling from the autumn. Instead, if you're a business, what you're facing right now is a bit of a fork in the road, a bit of a choice in our politics at the moment, between politics over economics or a clearer break towards a growth route, with that being the mission for the new chancellor. I'll just try and unpack sort of that choice, that fork in the road a bit more. So look, on the one hand, there are clearly some pretty big risks for businesses. The first is that the economy is deprioritized, that everything becomes secondary to the politics of the Conservative Party. Now, this really matters because confidence in the economy is wavering. We have firms who have paused investment because of the environment is already uncertain, and this could add even greater uncertainty. That's why we've been really banging the drum about this need for a kind of COBRA for the economy to grip the situation. And I think, if anything, the last 24 hours demonstrate the need to really double down on making growth the priority focus. There's also a risk that the incentives the government reaches for are political rather than economic. You would have already heard sort of Tory backbenchers talk about getting back to conservative policies. And what they mean by that is tax cuts for people, right? But that's probably not right for the economy. It's hard to believe that you could cut enough taxes for people to reverse the high inflation impact on consumption. Instead, the big risk is that rather than being the solution to the current cost of living crisis, that actually tax cuts could be inflationary. So if you're a business, and certainly what we'd be saying is any tax cuts should fuel investment, not inflation. And then finally, this doubt, right, over whether the new chancellor will deliver on the commitments to act on budget around people, capital, ideas. We've spoken about this many times in these webinars. And we shouldn't forget that Rishi's plans around capital, successor to the super deduction, people looking again about flex for the levy, and ideas reforming tax credits for R&D were his big plans for tackling the productivity challenge. And we've put a huge amount of effort to get to this point. And to borrow a phrase that he used quite a bit in his Radio 4 interview this morning, we'll be working at warp speed with Nadeem Zahawi to pick up on those. So those are the risks. But there is another direction this could go, right? We have a new chancellor who understands and values business hugely, who wants to move at speed to really grip the situation, to double down on growth, to get confidence back into the economy. That's a positive outcome that business will be hoping we see, and certainly something that we can work towards. So I'll just finish really briefly on what we're going to be doing in the next couple of days, just to kind of support members and work on that. So first and foremost, we're going to be making sure, doing everything we can to make sure that the economy doesn't get completely swamped by the politics. We can avoid a recession. Lots of talk about a recession. We can avoid a recession, but we need to focus on boosting confidence with pro-growth measures. We need to do that now. The second thing, we can fill the vacuum on how to respond to the economic environment. There's lots of debate about how to deal with this high inflationary environment. There's an opportunity, therefore, for business and the CBI to show that we are the ones with a plan and to work with the new chancellor at speed to implement that. And then finally, we will be mobilizing at real pace with those new ministers. We are already looking at how do we support officials who'll be preparing packs for the new chancellor, etc., to make sure that he has access to the business insight and solutions from day one about how to get confidence back into the economy. So just to kind of finish, big risk of peak politics, but actually there's a real opportunity now to sort of tilt the focus back to the economy, back to growth, back to confidence. That's going to be our sort of mantra in the coming days and weeks.
Great. Thanks very much, Sean. We're obviously going to come back to this in the course of this session. Angela, let's start with you and turn the focus to Northern Ireland. So what would you say the key issues and priorities for businesses in Northern Ireland at the moment?
It's interesting to hear John there talk about the uncertainty in Westminster, because as you know, we have quite a bit in Northern Ireland too. But I mean, I think from the outset, it is important to say that, you know, when I talk to companies across Northern Ireland, they're still in growth mode. A lot of them are still growing, their turnover is still growing, which is great. Trade is holding up well. And we saw the ONS stats. So outside of London, Northern Ireland was the only region that managed to have its GDP above pre-pandemic levels. So, you know, at a macro level, things are quite good, but they're, you know, obviously there are those fundamentals that haven't been resolved, particularly around labour. Companies still very concerned around the lack of labour, the lack of skills they talk about. And I suppose that's like other regions as well. We do, particularly around digital skills, have a big issue around growing the economy when we want to move towards that knowledge economy, but we don't have sufficient digital skills, software engineering, etc. And we also, because of lack of funding and cap in university places, we find it difficult to retain young people. A lot of talent goes to GB, and it doesn't come back. So that's a long-term issue, which is always the number one thing whenever I talk to companies. But obviously now, you know, they're starting to look at inflation. They you know, this is, you know, a huge crisis around energy. Cost of energy, the cost of gas, the cost of electricity, and also their labour costs rising really quite significantly, which is a big concern to members. We had a good call with human resource directors about 2 weeks ago, I think, and you know, they were sharing a number of ideas about how to retain their employees. They're really focusing on how to make it a good work experience and to particularly to retain young people and to keep them and to bring them into the office and to keep them there. Supply chain pressures, again, another big issue, access to components, particularly for the manufacturing sector. And then, of course, that is adding to the inflationary pressures as well, because when it's difficult to get components, the price goes up. And I suppose, you know, the political uncertainty that John referred to in Westminster doesn't bode well, because people like a stable kind of macroeconomic and political background for investment decisions. So that is an issue. And of course, we have in Northern Ireland the protocol issue, which is really quite unique, as well as not having our own executive in place. So all these things really do weigh quite heavily on the minds of chief executives. But I should say as well, though, that increasingly I'm noticing that companies are coming to us because they want to be really part of the solution and they want to add to the table in terms of solutions. And I think they do realise that government are grappling with this situation, that, you know, it is quite a unique crisis, and they want to be part of it, whether it's around supply chain issues or whatever. I mean, I'm having them give me ideas around what would help to support them with regards to investment, which we're feeding back into to Cannon Place, and they feed into the whatever chancellor's in place. but even around how do we build local clusters in Northern Ireland, semiconductors is a thing that has been brought up with me recently. They want to be part of that national conversation as to how do we fix things and make them better. And of course, the solutions, the technical solutions to the protocol, they know what would work for them and they want to be involved in those conversations as well. So quite a long list, I'm afraid. But yes, there's a lot going on, still in growth, but a lot of issues, and they want to be part of the solutions.
So many of those themes familiar across the rest of the UK, but of course a really distinct question around Brexit in Northern Ireland. Just bring us up to speed on that. How are companies in Northern Ireland reacting to the government's unilateral action over the Northern Ireland Protocol?
Yeah, well, I think it's important from the outset to say that they are continuing to work within the rules of the protocol. They are continuing to implement the current rules to make sure that their customers still get their product on time and in a legal fashion. So they are assuring customers, and I think they're quite busy doing that. They're assuring their customers that we can still supply you. We're still working within the legal remit, and supplies will continue without disruption. I mean, the protocol has worked for most companies. There's no doubt about it, particularly for big companies. It has come at a cost. And as somebody said to me, it's a bit of a stone in all our shoe. You know, everybody has a few issues that they have to deal with the protocol. And those are the things that we're trying to get ironed out. And, you know, the bill is working its way through Parliament. It won't make it to the Lords until October. Over the summer now, we do intend to be working with Treasury and Revenue and Customs, they're very keen to understand how will their proposals around a green lane and a red lane work. I'm getting from companies is that the green and red lanes are probably quite good because a lot of the stuff that comes into Northern Ireland is not at risk. So to get that to go through a green channel very quickly, and if it would stop them having to pay the supplementary declaration, they're definitely up for this. But I think there's a lot of questions that still need to be answered on that particular issue around, you know, what is the final destination? How is it defined? Also, how do mixed loads work? That doesn't, you know, it's not clear yet. And that's why those sectoral discussions are going to be really important for the agri-food and for the manufacturing sector over the summer. And I think probably if you were looking at the biggest issue around it, it's dual standards. So it's the proposal around you could pick which standards you want to adhere to. And I think for companies, particularly for the agri-food sector, and the manufacturing sector, that doesn't work well. The dual standards, you know, they find it very hard to, especially in an oil island market for food, where you know, product passes back and forth into the different jurisdictions multiple times. Dual standards are a big complication, and that is the big issue. As the UK diverges more from the regulations in the EU, that is when the protocol is going to get so much more difficult for Northern Ireland to implement. So that is a big issue. I think probably, you know, the business community very keen to see compromise on both sides. I mean, we do see solutions. There could be solutions there. There's no doubt about it. And I think probably things like a bespoke veterinary agreement for the agri-food sector, you know, the green lanes will work when we get it defined how it works. But what we really need is for the UK and the EU to be in a room to have grown-up discussions and to bring in business as well, because as I say, they understand on the ground the solutions that could be put into place to help resolve many of these technical problems. So the issue for them is really get talking again and bring us into the conversation and let's get this resolved, because there will have to be something unique for Northern Ireland in our post-Brexit world.
And this unresolved situation over the protocol, that's linked to the political stalemate in Northern Ireland, isn't it? Could just explain that for us. And where are we now in terms of the impasse over the executive?
Yes, it's always a bit of complication in Northern Ireland. I think we're the, somebody mentioned Achilles heel in the rest of the UK. I just say we're bit of a problem child, but given enough attention, I'm sure we'll get there. So yeah, we've had quite a bit of political turbulence. We had our election in May, of course, and then we saw the DUP, the second largest party, refusing to go back into government and form an executive until issues around the protocol get ironed out. So obviously they very concerned around the checks on goods between GB and Northern Ireland and feel that it undermines, I suppose, their rights under the Good Friday Agreement. So we're currently in a kind of state of paralysis, I guess, when it comes to politics in Northern Ireland. You know, we do have government ministers in place, but they're very limited in terms of what they can do. You know, they have a short-term budget. They can sign things off within their own department. But so many of the things that make this economy work and make it work well require a functioning executive. When it comes to cross-cutting issues, so that could be trying to achieve our low carbon targets, putting in place one thing that I'm really interested in, putting in place the infrastructure for electric vehicle chargers, the green growth stuff. It all requires the Department of Economy, you know, DERA, and Department of Infrastructure all to work together and to have executive sign off. So we can't move forward on those things until we have an executive back. And of course, nothing is going to appease the DUP until we see that bill working its way through Parliament. It's not going to hit the House of Lords until October. So, you know, there's not much hope for them to be in government. Probably, you know, most people are saying early in the new year, because, you know, even if they get back later in October, it'll take a while to have negotiations and to settle down and to form a government or an executive. And it's clearly something the business community are very fed up with. You know, that, you know, for them, this is a kind of a huge, big constraint on what we could be doing to improve the economy, to allow economic growth, whether, you know, that's things like putting money into long-term infrastructure or projects having long-term budgets, having a programme for government, an energy strategy, a low carbon strategy. So it's been held back in a number of ways, and even households are suffering too, because we know that those energy payments that the UK government has given money towards households for the winter for their energy payments, that cannot be distributed at the moment without a functioning executive. So I think probably it is important to note as well, though, that the civil service in the background are getting on with things. They are working on. We have a new head of the civil service, a female, first female ever in Northern Ireland, Jane Brady. She's working in the background on a programme for government. She's looking at all the things that they can potentially agree on. And then she's going to have this draft programme for government ready for when they do come back. But I wouldn't be too hopeful that that's going to happen until maybe early next year.
We're beginning to detect a theme here, aren't we, of a lack of strategic thinking, I think, kind of across the country. Leighton, when you're listening to what Angela's had to say, she talked about the cost of living crisis, the supply chain challenge, inflationary pressures. Are these kind of familiar questions, familiar challenges for businesses in Wales? How does the situation look to you?
They are very much so. I thought it'd be helpful to briefly refresh people's memory around kind of what's devolved in Wales. And it's around, business rates, income tax, economic development, transport, kind of education and health. And we've got around 5,000 civil servants, around 20 kind of sponsored bodies, kind of supporting nine ministers, headed by the Welsh Labour First Minister, Mark Drakeford. And we've got an annual budget of around 20 to 22 billion, and 50% of that goes on health. In terms of economic context, I think we know Wales is kind of older and sicker, and has a higher reliance.
50% and rising, Leighton. Sorry to interrupt you. Is that 50% and rising?
Going down. It's not going down. Yeah, we're a health service with an economy attached. that there's numerous reasons for that. Roderick Morgan used to say we've got 4% of the funding, but 6% of the need. I think there's something in that. It does impact how we can innovate and how we can kind of grow the economy. I think that's partly because there isn't an incentive to devolve government, because they get a Barnett consequential, and only 20% of their budget comes from taxation. So if more of it came from taxation, there'd be an incentive to grow the economy. In terms of a contributor to GDP, it is manufacturing. We're hanging on in there with Airbus in North Wales, kind of Tata in South Wales. And they're advanced. They are high emitters relatively, and they are capital intensive to improve them and to kind of make them fit for the future, which is a challenge, especially right now. There's around 210,000 businesses in Wales, registered businesses, and largest 1% employ around 30% of the workforce, which is surprising to many. As Andrew talked about in Northern Ireland, Welsh economy is officially kind of stronger than before the pandemic, but we sadly shrunk from July to September last year by 0.3%. We're the only part of the UK to do so. But there is positive stuff happening in terms of high growth sectors. We've seen digital, cyber, life sciences, advanced manufacturing, renewable energy and nuclear energy. So there's lots going on. In terms of the challenges, as Angela's mentioned, it is around cost, it is around certainty, and it is around people. There's no real difference in Wales. I think in terms of how can we weather the storm in the months ahead, and I think there is a real issue there around gross disposable household income. We are half that of London, and that will impact people's ability to deal with inflation. And around 23% live below the median income. There's a high level of poverty. So in terms of what we want, I think we want certainty. And I think that's because of the budget issues. I think what we want is a smarter public sector, a smarter interface, smarter business environment, and more incentives for investment. And I think the Welsh Government has ample opportunity to do that. They have invested less than elsewhere in innovating around public services. particularly for businesses, partly because they are not in favour of contracting out, and they're bringing all services they can back in-house, and they are also nationalising things where they can, such as the airport and our rail service. So that, I think there's an opportunity to look at things there in terms of how they deliver services, particularly digital services to business. There's the issue around coordination of policies. We've got a complicated policy and regulatory environment in Wales through multi-level governance, particularly now with levelling up. And I think there is a need to better coordinate that. Under Theresa May, there was a comparatively kind of a Rolls-Royce set up with intergovernmental kind of relations. And I know the First Minister was a fan of that. That doesn't exist. That was taken apart by the new Prime Minister. And I think there's a need to go back there. The UK internal market, which is trying to ensure a kind of level playing field, should incentivize those discussions, but it needs to be a strategic discussion rather than a ad hoc discussion based on events that are coming towards us. And in terms of certainty, it would really help if the UK government could kind of provide that financial heft that just isn't available for key anchor projects in Wales, because we've been talking about Wylfa B nuclear power station for many years now, and it's a, if it goes ahead, you know, 10 to 15 billion pound project, bigger than the London Olympics, and it could really make a difference to North Wales. In terms of people, very, very kind of finally, if you like, as I mentioned around kind of labour shortages and record high vacancies. Despite that, the majority of our Wales members, when we surveyed them, intended on recruiting more people over the next 12 months. And one thing we've really found has driven this, particularly in professional services, is what we're calling virtual London. So there's lots of London companies cruelly headhunting talented people in Welsh companies and saying, you know, just work from your home, come to see us when you can, and we've just double what you're currently being paid. And that has led to a number of firms losing talent. And it's meant that they've had to focus on what they can do. If they can't manage to match salary, how can they incentivize people to stay, but also people to come to them for less money. That's kind of where we are right now.
Leighton, thanks for the overview. Before we turn to Scotland, just want to ask one specific question. Industrial relations, obviously, in the UK at their worst really for decades, and are likely only to get worse as the sort of cost of living crisis intensifies. Keir Starmer mentioned in a speech recently that he sort of pointed to the kind of situation with rail workers in Wales who are employed by the Welsh government and haven't gone on strike over pay. Can we look to Wales for sort of clues about labour relations under a Labour government? Just give us your take on that.
Very quickly, this seems quite dull and academic, but as a topic. But as you've just mentioned, there are real world impacts both for businesses and commuters. And this is the social partnership model that the Welsh government have developed, you know, over the last 10 years. It's very common in mainland Europe, and it's well developed in Ireland. Basically, what it is a legal structure that brings businesses, trade unions, and government together to talk continually about strategic issues. So at a national level, CBI, TUC, and the then First Minister in response to the financial crisis in 2007 got around the table and developed PROACT and REACT, to really good employment and training schemes that saved tens of thousands of jobs in Wales, and we developed that within a few days. That's the power of social partnership, and more recently the government intend to roll it out at a local level. So in terms of the ASPBs, in terms of Transport for Wales, there's a similar model that exists there, and the relationships that have developed over the years have meant that there is a trust amongst employer, employee and government that has meant that this has been diverted. Now, will that be the case all the time? It could be an interesting few months ahead, but in this instance, it has worked. And I think that's something that Keir Starmer likes the look of, but we'll see what happens.
Thanks, Leighton. And James, to turn to you and bring us up to date on Scotland. Obviously, the sort of the big news of last week was Nicola Sturgeon setting a date for IndyRef 2. Let's take a step back from this and tell us, what does it actually mean?
Yeah, I would like to say it was a bit quieter up here in Scotland, but it's just as mad as it's everywhere else in the UK right now. Nicola Sturgeon did say she plans to hold an independence referendum on the 19th of October 2023. But the UK government have been quite clear that they do not intend to grant a Section 30 order. That's a power that would essentially enable a legal referendum to be held by the Scottish government, as happened in 2014. The Scottish government, though, are trying to sort of fast track any legal challenges by presenting their own draft bill to the UK Supreme Court. A couple of issues here, though. Firstly, the received wisdom is that the Scottish Government doesn't have the power to hold a referendum in the first place, so therefore they can't actually hold the vote. Secondly, though, the Supreme Court themselves might not rule on this, simply because it's actually theoretical legislation. It's legislation which hasn't actually been passed or presented to the Scottish Parliament yet. Hmm. Added to that, yesterday, the Lord Advocate, that's essentially the equivalent to the Attorney General in Scotland, confirmed her view that she does not have the sort of degree of confidence that legislating for a referendum is within Holyrood's powers. With that in mind, the Supreme Court is still not likely to even consider the case until September, with a ruling expected around October time. So that's sort of the legal background. But even with the announcement last week, the First Minister herself announced plans to make the next UK general election a sort of de facto referendum on independence. I think that sort of shows herself that she's not necessarily convinced there'll be a referendum before then, and the fact that you're talking about other ways of even achieving independence. But we all know that elections don't always go in the narrative that politicians want. So I think that means with a 2024 UK election, most likely, we're going to face 2 years of constitutional wrangling. And in terms of where businesses are sort of looking at this, I think from what I've been hearing, it's sort of a lot of wait and see from any companies operating in Scotland, whether they're headquartered here or simply have a footprint. The constitutional aspect has been part of the landscape for the best part of a decade. That's not to say the Constitution doesn't have an impact on where businesses choose to invest or expand operations, but more often than not, it's a wider set of risk and reward that's considered. And we all know the challenges that firms are facing across the UK, as has been mentioned already, you know, in terms of access to skills, rising costs, whether that's energy, access to material, shipping and transport costs. There's a lot of sort of business needs that are going on that's sort of playing in the foreground to the constitutional stuff in the background. And it's certainly something that we are talking to members about, and I suspect it's not going to be resolved, excuse me, anytime soon. We will be talking for this for a while yet. But in the past week or so, I have been speaking to firms. And I said, there is an element of wait and see. Some have no proactive plans to start looking at independence and what that means for the firm yet. Others have indicated they are looking to sort of re-establish internal working groups on it. I'm sure many firms on this call had something similar in the run-up to Brexit. And the challenge I'm hearing so far is, what actually should we be planning for? So in that, we don't know. The Scottish Government, though, have promised to release a series of papers. That's around issues on currency, trading arrangements, EU membership. But that's still in the future. So firms can't plan for that theoretical situation they don't yet know about. So I suspect we'll have a significantly clearer idea about the legal ramifications in the autumn. Until then, they'll hold tight.
Just very briefly, James, what's the intersection of Westminster politics and IndyRef?
Well, of course, we all look at the polling, and numbers for Boris Johnson have never been particularly great in Scotland. So I think there's a looking at, you know, his popularity as Prime Minister. I don't necessarily think it's a correlation between Boris Johnson being Prime Minister and there being a yes vote. I think it makes it more likely, perhaps, if there were to be a referendum. But I don't think the two are necessarily sort of linked up in that way. I think, you know, you've seen as well sort of Labour, in terms of where they are in the polls at the moment, looking more likely, if the numbers are to borne out, they would form the next government. I think there are some in the independence movement who would view that negatively, because that would make a referendum actually less likely to be held, because Labour have themselves this week actually been quite clear that they don't plan to do any deals with the SNP. So there is a lot at play, I think, in terms of over the next 2 years as to whether Boris Johnson stays, whether there's a change of government, and actually that will impact potentially on the numbers and on the likelihood of there being a referendum.
Thanks, James. John, I'd like to bring this back to you and just bring us up to date first on what's been happening almost as we've been speaking, because there have been some developments, haven't there?
There have been. I've just got a note in the chat that says we've had a few more ministerial resignations. I know that Laura Trott and Will Quince have both resigned, but perhaps more sort of importantly, some of the important backbenchers have also come out against the Prime Minister, Robert Halfen, Lee Anderson. These are very sort of supportive red wall, if you like, sort of leading figures. So, you know, it does feel like there's a little bit more momentum this morning, building on last night's resignations. We've obviously got PMQs that is due to take place later today. I think we also now know that Sajid Javid, you have a right to kind of give a resignation statement to the House when you step down. So the Health Secretary or the former Health Secretary is going to be deploying that particular right later. So it would be interesting to see what he says. And then we believe that also the Prime Minister is at the liaison committee at 3 o'clock. This is the committee that brings together all the select committee chairs to give the PM a bit of a grilling. That could certainly be worth tuning in for. And then, as we sort of spoke earlier, we're expecting the 1922 exec committee to meet later tonight to sort of work out next steps. So listen, it's a highly fluid situation. I suspect there might be a few more twists and turns.
So plenty more to come out of Westminster today. But if we just think about one of the important new figures, Nadeem Zahawi, give us a sense, John, of how you see him taking on the job of Chancellor and what direction he's going to take this in.
Yeah, it's a super question. I mean, the honest answer is we're going to have to wait and see. But there's certain things that we can probably deduce from what he's done so far and also how he's ended up in the post. So I think first and foremost, I spoke at the beginning about the former Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, citing kind of economic differences in policy for part of his resignation. So we can feel sort of pretty confident that the Prime Minister has made the offer to Nadeem Zahawi on the basis that they're aligned on future economic policy. And it could well be that a big element of that is around sort of investment, pro-investment tax cuts. So perhaps on the big levers of economic policy, you could perhaps deduce that the new Chancellor and the Prime Minister are aligned on that. I mean, what we know from Nadeem Zahawi's background, he was one of the co-founders of YouGov, the polling company. He's previously had roles, as I mentioned, in vaccine minister and also as a junior minister in BEIS. So we know that he's a knowledgeable former businessman. He's sort of pro-market, he's pro-innovation, and he understands the importance of stability and certainty from a business planning perspective, which is helpful. And then I guess in his most recent role, when he's been education secretary, he's been there for a short period of time, sort of 10 to 12 months. There's been lots of kind of difficulty around the skills bill that has taken up quite a lot of his time. But one interesting thing that we do know is that he set up the Unit for Future Skills. And this was a unit within his department that was designed to look at what are the big growth sectors and opportunities in the economy, where is the current labour market in terms of delivering the skills that we need, and how do we plan accordingly for that. So what we can certainly hope for is that he takes that enthusiasm for skills as a policy lever for growth and takes it into the role of Chancellor. But all in all, as I mentioned at the start, there's a really big opportunity now. Yes, there are risks, but there's an opportunity to kind of grip the uncertainty, to provide a bit of momentum behind growth, to focus on those big levers of productivity, and to build a bit of a bridge to the autumn budget to try and get back some momentum into the economy. So that's certainly what we'll be hoping for and talking to him and his team about in the sort of coming days.
And you touched on this in your opening comments when you talked about the food strategy and the energy strategy. You said there were some missing pieces in those strategies. If we think about food, I mean, one of the big pieces that was missing was really kind of government action on health, on sort of salt and sugar. Felt like maybe that difficult decision had been sort of ducked, perhaps partly because of the cost of living crisis. I mean, do you think that if there is kind of increased instability now in Westminster, there are going to be a lot more difficult decisions that get ducked by this over the course of this year?
I think whenever there's political instability, what you find is that the government's bandwidth and its ability to horizon scan suddenly shrinks. So they suddenly become focused on less, and their ability to kind of forecast and look further into the future becomes more challenging. That's clearly a big risk. I think what we would be saying to the government is actually, there is an opportunity to go short term, right? Let's focus short term on one priority, and that priority is the economy and building confidence in business, focusing on how business investment can be the lever to help get us out of the cost of living crisis. So actually, if what it does do is is get the kind of government machine to narrow in its focus onto the economy, which's got to be the most important thing right now, then actually there's a real opportunity. But look, to your point, there are gaps in sort of government policy making. I wouldn't necessarily expect there to be a big flurry of additional activity. I suspect there will be a flurry of activity to perhaps try and demonstrate that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor are in control, that actually they're focused on the big priorities. And as I mentioned at the start, that isn't necessarily a bad thing for business, when what we want is kind of confidence building measures, focus on growth, a bit of certainty in what is a pretty uncertain political background.
And Angela, just to come to you on this and to think about the implications for Northern Ireland of what's going on in Westminster, what's the reaction really in Northern Ireland politics to what's happening?
I think the biggest issue for us is obviously we want that deal between the UK and the EU, and we do fear that while the politics is a bit wild in Westminster, that the EU won't invest the time until they know that things are settled, that they're not going to waste their time talking to ministers that they feel might not be there next week. So that again is going to delay any solutions that we can get in terms of a compromise on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
Okay. And if we just one subject that's kind of close to my heart that I want to come back to, and maybe with you, James, so we think about climate and we think about the return to the North Sea. What's the mood amongst companies in Aberdeen really at the moment about kind of which direction that's going in?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that now former Chancellor got a pretty chilly reception when he was up there a couple of weeks ago from the industry. I think there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And of course, a lot of the producers and manufacturers are working towards their own net zero targets right now as well. Many are involved in the new ScotWind programme. So, for example, like BP working with Scottish Power to create new renewable energy solutions. I think the sector in sort of the wider northeast is struggling as well, because as Leighton mentioned, you know, this sort of the challenge of jobs and skills. You know, there's a lot of lawyers that are required for that industry up there, and there's a lot of lawyers that are being offered big bucks in London right now that Aberdeen firms simply can't compete with. So it's not just the sort of the oil and gas industry as such, it's the wider sort of the accountants, the lawyers, the whole sort of ecosystem up there. So it's a bit of uncertainty. It'll be interesting to see what the new Chancellor has to say as well, because I know that the bill did, I think, pass last night, or at least further process was made on the windfall tax as well. So, yeah, uncertainty.
Right. Yeah, the watchword of the panel discussion today. Thank you all very much. Thanks, John, and all the rest of our panellists for really useful insights on what's happening across the country at the moment. Next week, we're going to be looking at the issue of recruitment, which Angela and the others have touched on today. And we'll have some recruitment specialists with us. We'll talk through the issues, but we'll also think about what the potential solutions are. We'll be back at the same time and place, 10 a.m. next Wednesday, the 13th. Thank you all very much.